Welcome to the Sales Development Podcast, your go-to resource for all things pipeline and revenue production in the tech sales world. Technology marketing, sales development, sales, and revenue operations have combined to create the go-to market engine fueling the success of SaaS startups and established companies alike. Each week, the Sales Development Podcast dives deeply into the strategies, tactics, people, processes, and technology that fuels the revenue machine. The Sales Development Podcast is brought to you by 10bound. Get more free resources, insights, and intelligence today at 10bound.com. And be sure to like and subscribe on YouTube.
Hello, 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 everybody. Welcome to another edition of the Sales Development Podcast. I'm David Delaney, your host, and I am joined today by my esteemed mentor, friend, colleague, partner in crime here, Mr. Richard Harris. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm good, man. It's good to see you. It's always fun to catch up with you. And you're one of those people when you sit down and talk with David, like it's just like two old college buddies hanging out. We haven't known each other since college, but it just the conversation is always so fun and so much mutual respect and admiration and so much in common. So I'm glad to be here and I appreciate it.
Oh my gosh. I'm so excited to talk with you. I've met you out in the street around a Dreamforce. It must have been like 2015. So we're going back like almost 10 years now.
Oh, geez. Yeah, well, you're right. Wow. Okay.
That's amazing. We're getting old, dude. Back in the sales hacker days. I think I met you, I was with Max and we were walking around at Dreamforce.
That's right. I remember.
You've done so much. So you're a world famous sales trainer. So you actually work with sales teams to improve their skills, SDRs, inside sales, all through the ranks of the team. And you've been doing that for a long time with Richard Harris Consulting Group. And you've got an awesome reputation. Whenever somebody asks me for a great sales trainer, I don't want to diss anybody, but I always send them to Richard Harris.
He does. I know he at least sends them to me. Maybe he sends them to a couple just to be agnostic in that, but I always appreciate it.
Yes. And the feedback is always awesome. You created Neat Selling, which is I want to talk to you about. You've got a new book coming out called The Seller's Journey.
Yeah, just coming out. It drops February 22nd, depending on whether you get this before then or after then. It'll be on Amazon on February 22nd and all the other places you can get something.
Okay. Before I forget, you also are an accomplished podcast host and webinars. And if you need like a talking head about anything sales related, Richard's your guy. You put on an event, which is amazing. This could be like a whole show called Surf and Sales, where you gather a very select group of top-notch sellers and go down to Costa Rica, right?
Yeah, we do. I feel like we're out there talking about all my stuff, so I feel a little weird, but yes.
That's why you're here.
We find out more at surfandsales.com, but we take people down to Costa Rica. We spend about 4 hours a day doing some content, whether it's sales, mental health, marketing, customer success. And then we have lessons every day for people who don't surf. Nobody has to be a surfer. And a lot of times you're just spending time getting to know someone. You're just sitting there hanging and talking to somebody for an hour or two. We love to have people. Next one's coming up in November 2024, just a few months away, waiting for David to get his ticket.
I know, right? You guys ask me every year. One of these years, I swear, my kids are getting older now and I'm going to be able to go down there. It sounds amazing. And if you're into sales, if you're into improving your skills, and even beyond that, Richard writes a lot about mental health and being able to deal with all the stress in our business, whether you're a business owner or a salesperson, whatever, you have a lot of great advice for people. So
thank you. I appreciate it.
I just want to make sure that everybody knows that. It looks like you've taken your wisdom and what you've learned and compressed it into a book.
Yes. It's kind of two parts in it. First part talks a lot about sales and sales mindset and how humans make decisions and a good sales process and those kind of things. And then the other part's really tactical. There's sections around how do you actually bucket the right number of questions around need or access to authority or economic impact. What are the tactics you can use around the words and versus but, how to negotiate with procurement, how to stop discounting. So it's both part theoretical and then very tactical as well. That's my thing. It's like, I want people, if they're going to spend some money on a book, which by the way, if you ever do, first sentence in my book gives you my email address. I'll reimburse you if you think it's terrible. I'll Venmo your money back. I want people to walk away with something they could actually do right now, right in the moment, one thing. And there's many. There's 13 tactics that are not in most people's sales playbooks. So that's why I've done it this way.
You like condense it down. They can read this. And the first part is getting the mindset, then actually apply the skills that they learn. So is this patterned along with the training that you do? Or is this like a do-it-yourself manual for the training?
That's a really good question. Yeah, it kind of is. There's a lot of stuff in here that I train on. If people were to read this book and implement it all, yes, they would have my training. They would have that. I think the difference is there's always nuances. Everybody's got the same challenge around doing better discovery around need. However, the challenge is, what does one company need to do it, and how do they need to do it, and what's it need to sound like versus another, in addition to making sure everybody sounds authentic to themselves. Like, it's not a book of scripts. I don't want people to think that. There are some great nuggets in there, though. I just want to make sure people don't overlook it. David, you know me. It's got my snark in there. In fact, I spoke to my mom, and she's been reading the book, and that's always a fun conversation when your parents read the book, and then your parents are in sales. She's like, yeah, there's a lot of F-bombs in here, honey. I'm like, well, mom, you do know me, right? Like, you know? She's like, well, what happens if some big person at a big corporation reads it and gets offended? I'm like, I never knew him before. I wouldn't even know now. I'd be like, thanks for the $5 I got on my commission, my royalty.
Wow.
They can send the money back. This I don't know. So it's written with a certain level of snark and humor and things, because we've all been there. We've all had these pains and struggles, and we still do. I don't care how good a salesperson you are. We still get frustrated. People still ghost. People still promise, overpromise, and underdeliver. And so I wrote it with that intent in mind, that like, I get it. I feel it. I experience it too. I didn't want it to be a textbook that you get in a college.
Right. It's tricky for salespeople in that you can get the knowledge. Literally, you've taken your years of experience and put it into a book for $20 or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
They can get the knowledge of that, but then bridging the gap to behavior change. So like taking that knowledge and actually do something with it. I have like an entire library of books about sales and marketing and getting rich mm-hmm. and all this stuff. Some of it I've definitely used and it's helped a lot, but there's a lot of books that I'm just like, I haven't gone from knowledge to actual behavior change. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And believe me, I think we're all that way. And even when I do training, I'm always telling people, we always wrap the session with, well, what's the one thing you're going to implement next week? We talk about 20 things. Name one, just one thing you're going to do. And everybody has to design to make them accountable to it for when we do the reinforcement. That's kind of the goal, is like, I would think Never Split the Difference is one of the most popular books in sales. And it's one of those books that you can read all these tactics and you can only kind of go do one at a time. And it's written in such a way that you want to go back and read it again anyway, because it's also fun. And it's written in such a way that you go back to learn. And that was a piece of it for me, was making sure that there's a lot of vignettes, like little chapters, that you can't do all of it at once. So I want people to be able to walk away and learn something and then go, oh, I should go look at that again or something. So,
yeah, that's amazing.
That's my thought.
There's training and then there's coaching.
Yes. And execution.
Yeah. I still do coaching with people. And this is what I need. Is I get on the phone and I'm just like, hey, did you do that stuff that we talked about last week?
No. Yeah, they never do.
I've been playing the guitar for like 20 years and I still stink. I'm working now with a teacher. And what it does is he gives me like a little training for a new thing. But in the back of my head, I'm like, I have to show up on Thursday at 7 o'clock on the Zoom. And I'm going to feel like I wasted my money if I didn't practice. Do something different. And I already feel like I'm getting better. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Again, he's holding you accountable. We remodeled the house and we put in a treadmill and the TRX thing that you can use your body weight to work out. And I still have a trainer and I even do it on Zoom. I don't even go, but he holds me accountable. He makes sure I do it. And am I exercising as much as I should? No, but I'm exercising more than I would if I didn't have him. So that's why I think it's so good to have a coach or a trainer or a mentor, whatever it is you want to call, because you need it to get better at guitar, even if you've done it for so many years. You need it to work out, even if you've done it. You need it to do sales and you need it for therapy. So like, that's the concept of it, is like, how do I do this in a way that helps people?
Yeah. And I think salespeople are like, I don't want to say afraid to ask for help, but it's like your manager probably has six other direct reports and stuff. So you don't feel super comfortable like asking them to hold you accountable. They might have a different style and stuff like that. But then you look out into the world and it's like, well, where do I find a coach to hold me accountable? It just seems weird. It doesn't seem
we don't
like
know how to do it. I also think too, I think our generation didn't know how to do it. I think the younger generation, the millennials and the Gen Zs, like it's constant for them. They sort of have grown up with it, at least in my opinion. I don't know. Maybe it is hard for them. I don't know. But it feels like it's easier for them than it is for us, just based on the access to people or knowledge or learning compared to what you and I grew up with for so long.
Oh my gosh, it's so true. And it's almost like the opposite. There's like this fire hose of advice coming at you, especially if you're scrolling social media. It's like, there's so much advice. You need some way to make it into a thing where, okay, I know that Thursday he's going to ask me if I did it or not. And that's all you really need to be able to put it together.
Agreed. Agreed.
Let me ask you this. What is neat selling? Right on the cover, it says the neat selling system. So what is that?
Yeah. Neat is something I came up with, I don't know, 8 or 10 years ago, just trying to differentiate myself and try to stand out in a crowd of sales training. And it stands for need, the economic impact of that need, access to authority, because you're never going to talk to the authority person early, and timeline. So it's N-E-A-T. And I put it together. At first, I was going to call it Nate and have a little character, Nate. But then I realized that if I reorganize the words N-E-A-T, I could make it look like a compass with N at the top and E at the side and then A and T. And that really fit because I don't expect people to follow it in a particular order. It's often we do try to dive into need. It's a typical beginning point. However, you don't have to if you don't want to. If the customer wants to take you down a certain path that's about my boss said to do this, or, hey, we just had this challenge. We got breached and now we've got this problem. We could talk about other things like economic impact or access to authority. So it's built to be a compass so that it gives you a guide and reminds you to do things without being so rigid that you have to follow it in a very specific order. That's the essence of it all. And it bolts on to everything. It bolts on to Challenger. It bolts on to Medic, and it can bolt on to any of them. Like, I'm not here to try and tell people to rip and replace their system and replace it. You can make it what you want. So for some, neat is a philosophy. For some, it's a process. And for some, it's a methodology. And so it's designed to be customized to what the customer needs, not what Richard says you have to do. People come in, for my opinion, they definitely want someone like us to come in and tell them what to do. But I'm not going to do it in such a way that it's cookie cutter and straight out of the box.
Right. And neat, is it like a way to qualify a deal? So for example, I get an inbound lead or an SDR sets up a meeting. I sit down and I've got like the compass in front of me. Am I trying to qualify if this is a deal or not? Or where do I use it within the sales process?
That's great. For me, it's about understanding what's the economic impact of the pain someone's having. And if I can determine that, which is a present value, David, you call me and I say, okay, so what's going on over there that made you want to talk to me, David? And you say, oh, we had this, or we missed our quota, or we did this. I'm like, great. How many people missed your quota? By how much? How much was left on the table? Now, all of a sudden, I have this impact, I have this economic impact that they missed the number by this percentage or this dollar amount. And then, okay, well, how's it going this year? What do the quotas look like this year? What's changing this year? What's the economic impact if you don't do this or if you do? So if I drive to all that and I can dollarize and numberize the need at an economic impact level, it helps me understand what their real pain is. It also builds a lot of trust in the way you do it. And from there, I can try to qualify, right? Like, I'm always sort of torn between the, here's the list of 10 questions you need to ask. Well, yes, and don't I at least want to understand what their pain is and build that trust with them in such a way that when I express, get them to tell me the dollarization of their pain, because they probably haven't done it, now it's easier for me to ask those other questions in terms of qualifying. So anyway, so that's the goal of it. And you don't stop. If you think about it, you're always reconfirming need because every time a new person comes in the decision-making group, you got to understand theirs. You're always trying to understand the economic impact because, again, as each department comes in and has a touch on this, they each have an impact to this. Access to authority. The first couple of people you talk to aren't going to be the authority figure, and you don't really need to. You don't need to know who's going to make the decision in a first or second call. What you need to know is who's the skeptic. It's easier to say, hey, David, this has been a great conversation. I'm willing to bet at the end of this conversation, you're going to go back and have a conversation internally. David's going to say yes. I'm like, great. Who's the most skeptical person on that team, David? What are they skeptical about? Because now I can arm David with the right information and intel. David knows I don't want him to go look foolish bringing me up. And David doesn't want to be a ping pong ball going back and forth. I want to know who the skeptics are before I figure out who makes the final decision. Like that to me is how I, generally speaking, people don't disagree. Occasionally some people are like, well, I want to know ahead of time. And I'm like, great. What's that ever done for you on the second and third call when you still haven't spoken to them, right? Doesn't do you anything. And you're never going to get to them until you get through the skeptics.
That's really helpful. And then timeline. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, do you ever get on calls where they're very tight-lipped and they don't want to give you information and they just want to know like, hey, Richard, how much does it cost? When can you do it? Can you show up at my SKO next week?
I had one of those today, as a matter of fact.
Okay. How do you get them from just give me the information to open up and let's talk about your economics and all
this
stuff?
Yeah. So this is the quick version, which is, hey, David, I understand commercial terms is super important for you. And by all means, the calendar. So yeah, let's talk about the calendar. Because if I can't even show up, then not even worth another conversation. Okay, I can show up. So David, before we get off this call, yeah, you'll have my commercial terms and they're really simple and easy to understand. However, I don't even know if I'm the right fit for you. Before we even go there, can we even determine what it is you're looking for? And if you don't like what I do, you don't like the answers I'm giving, you're welcome to say so. You won't offend me. And likewise, David, if I can't help you, I'll tell you, like, David, if you say, Richard, can you come in and do demo training and how to give a good demo? I can, David, but it's not my strong suit. Do you want to keep talking? If not, here's Bob over here. I'll refer you to somebody. I get people to slow down. And sometimes people get irritated and that's okay. And you as a salesperson have to decide, what are you willing to give up? Because the moment you give that up in a first 2-minute conversation, you're going to give up everything else they ask for the rest of the sales process. You're going to give in on a discount. You're going to give in on a timeline. You're going to give in on 100 different things because you gave in too early. And I will say this last thing, and then I'll shut up again. It's very easy for Richard Harris, who runs his own business, to say these things and actually do them because I don't have a boss. Like, I am my own boss. My wife checks in on my pipeline. That's very different. So if people are feeling pressured differently than the way I describe it, I get it. Like, I'm not here to say, tell them to F off, which I wouldn't say verbally, but I would be like, it sounds like this isn't the right fit if you're going to insist on pricing. So I'm going to let you go talk to some other people and here's why you'll come back to me. I can say that. I get it because it's my business. I know a lot of people want to be able to say those things, but maybe they can't. Maybe that's too aggressive for your company. They don't want you to say it that way. Maybe you're behind on quota. I do want people to listen to this and kind of go, Richard makes it sound so easy, but he has no clue. I got a clue. I know. That's my hope.
I feel like sales calls are, I think it was Mike Tyson. Somebody said,
yeah, you got to play until you're punched in the face.
And then they get punched in the face. It's almost like you want to have that compass or sort of a framework to work off of. So you have some sort of boundaries and process in your sales call. But at the same time, it's like, dude, you're going to get punched in the face.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. Like, I've been in a situation recently where you have like 3 calls with the CEO of the company. You've worked with them before. They love you. Everything's great. And you're like counting the check, you know, before you even do it. And all of a sudden, the last call, they bring in a CFO person or somebody who's like in charge. It's almost like adult supervision, finally. And
yeah,
they just tear you apart. And next thing you know, the deal is just gone. It's dead.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's a good piece. That's why I focus so hard on economic impact, because when you dollarize the pain right now, you can help your prospect or customer realize they don't have a headache, they have a migraine. And I guarantee you, even with some basic back of the envelope math questions, the pain is 3x what they think it is every time. which is very different. So by the time I get to the talking person, the money person, because they all turn around and say, well, what's the ROI? Prove the ROI, blah, blah, blah. It's like, dude, you can't prove ROI. I could come up with the best formula in the world written by ChatGPT, and you'd still question the validity because it's something in the future that you can't predict. But what I can tell you is this is your pain. And if you don't do something to solve it, and these are your numbers, Mr. and Mrs. CFO, do you feel like that's how big the pain is? And they'll kind of go, yeah, it seems about right. Okay, well, great. Then what are you going to do instead? Because there's no magic pill that someone's going to give you an ROI. And if they do, they're lying to you. ROI is used as one of the biggest scare tactics ever in negotiation for salespeople. I get it. I understand it. This is why it's so critical that if you have economic impact, if you have dollarization, if you have numbers behind the pain they're experiencing that's present currently, it throws away their ROI in a, I would say, a much nicer than I have here, but you can have that in a very professional conversation and just as a conversation. It's super easy.
And maybe it's in the book, folks. Are there some questions in there or some ways to bring up that dollarization elephant in the room?
It is. And if you'll let me, I'll run through it so people can get a sense of it. Is that all right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you're going to be my prospect. And just for backstory, you got 10 sales reps. That's all you need to know. Okay. And you missed quota last year. That's all we need to know going in. By the way, there are things I do before I get into this questioning, this thing called a respect contract and earning the right to ask these questions. So I've done all that for those listening. But I'll say, so David, you'd mentioned that your team missed quota. Where did you land versus where you were supposed to land?
67%.
67%. What does that represent? Is that $1 million miss? Is that a $3 million miss?
Yeah, about 1.5.
Okay, 1.5. And at 67% of the goal, did you still grow over last year? Did the goals go way up because 2022 was so great and then 23 hit? Or was it, no, it was a pretty steady even year anyway?
Yeah, 22 goals. I mean, the 23 goals were built on 22 under the assumption that there would still be the same trajectory. Okay. And then we missed.
Okay. But did you surpass the 2022 number as a whole? Did you still do 110% of the previous year or did you come in flat?
Yeah, well, essentially flat.
Okay, essentially flat. Okay. And you've got 10 reps, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how many reps on the team missed quota?
Four.
Four. Okay. And what's your average deal size?
25K.
Okay. And what's your average sales cycle?
90 days.
90 days. Okay. And if you think about what you're trying to accomplish here, at the end of a training, whether you choose Richard or not, you need the team to be better at blank, blank, and blank. What is it? What fills in those blanks?
Yeah. Objection handling, dollarization, ROI conversation, and closing.
Got it. So what objections are giving you all the most trouble?
Essentially, they don't understand how we're different than other companies in our...
Okay. It's a direct comparison. You've been commoditized, it sounds like. When competition stuff comes up, can you tell in your CRM what percentage of deals you're losing to different competitors versus if competition never comes up and you always win? Like, is it that big of a difference?
Yeah, definitely. When competition comes up, it could go, I'd say 50-50. If we do a good job explaining it, then we might get it. If not, they go with the competitor.
Got it. Okay. Well, David, I'm going to give you a couple of tips that you can try right now if you haven't done this with your team. Encourage your team that when someone brings up the competition, to simply say, oh, that feature that the competition does that you were asking about, how important is that to making this decision? Or are you just asking out of curiosity? Because sometimes the people bring up something and we think, oh my God, we don't have that feature. So therefore we're going to lose the deal. When in fact, we don't even know if it's that important. That's one way. The other one I would tell you to try with your team, David, is teach them to say something like this. Hey, David, can I tell you why some of our customers moved from that platform to ours? This is the kind of stuff I would teach your team, David. I would teach them very simple things and we would make sure that it's customized to what you do. Based on what you said, it looks like you've got this many reps and this is your average sales cycle and this is this, and you're missing this many deals. So it's costing you this much. And we're already into February. And if you've got a 90-day sales cycle, if you had me show up for training, it's still going to take some time to 30 days to start to see some changes, although you'll see many overnight. I'm going to pause there. But that's how you do it. You create some level of dollarization. And I could have done more back of the envelope math on that. But I asked the questions and you can get to there. So then now we have an economic impact of this challenge they're having. And by the time we finish diving in, also we can better handle the, I don't have a budget or that's too high or any of those kind of things. So that's what it means to dollarize a little bit as an example. And I know that was a very quick and dirty, there's more to it, but that's the basics.
And have you ever had a situation where, and I don't know if you present it like this, but it's like, hey, if you give me $10,000 to train your team, you're going to get a $250,000 return based on the numbers that you're giving me over the next 30 days. That's a 1,000% return.
Right.
Have you ever had them come back and just be like, Richard, that's BS. I know that that's BS. And not that you would ever say that, but it's like, essentially, that's what you're saying, right? That by giving you 10 grand, they're going to get 250 back.
Which is absolutely okay for me to say. Mm-hmm. And I will say this to everybody all the time. This often comes up around the ROI conversation. And I sort of go into this economic impact and I launch into the ROI. And if I'm talking to David and I know he's got to go talk to the CFO, I'm like, you go hashtag blame Richard that David says anytime you ask him about ROI, he's going to blow you up on economic impact because he knows you're never going to believe what you tell him anyway. So don't ask him the question unless you want to hear Richard go. Now, will David go do that? I don't know. But that being said, a lot of times how it comes up for me is, hey, Richard, so, okay, this is what you do. Okay, it's 15,000, blah, blah, blah. So if we only close two deals, we pay for you. And I go, whoa. Well, if you've only closed two extra deals to pay for me, then I failed. As a trainer, that's not what you're hiring me for. You just told me you have four reps not hitting numbers. If I can't make those four reps exceed those numbers, if you're going to spend 15 grand on me, yeah, you should expect a 10x return. By the way, CFOs expect a 10x return. Like if you buy something, you should expect that kind of return because you got to pay for everything. And I don't mean the training. It's all the overhead. It's all those things. If I can't come in and help all four of your people, I shouldn't be hired. So tell me why it's wrong to think that I couldn't do that. And now all of a sudden, they're kind of stuck and they end up reselling themselves on me. And in addition, I would even go so far to say, well, okay, but I'm confused. Then why are you talking to any of us? Because I assume you're going to give all of us the same objection. You're going to say, oh, I don't believe your 10x return. What number would you believe? Because they're just trying to do it to scare you and negotiate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They may in their heart believe that it won't happen. I'm not saying they won't believe it. But humans are irrational beings and they will rationalize irrational thoughts. And this irrational thought that I'm not going to believe your ROI, well, then you either better be able to prove it or call them out on it to have them prove to you why you're wrong. Again, why economic impact is so important is like, you just told me you got a $2.5 million a year problem and you're going to tell me that I can't help you. Then why are you talking to anybody? Why don't you go fix it then? And I do go into these conversations with that level of confidence. If I say it out loud, I sound cocky. If I walk in with the confidence to know that I know how to answer these questions professionally and politely, then that's confidence. And that's kind of what they're measuring.
Yeah. I mean, it's tricky because as a sales trainer, they're judging you based on how you sell. You have to be the bright, shining example.
That's the easiest thing. That's the best part about my job is like, are you really going to try and negotiate? Like, you know, my first answer is, aren't you hiring me to teach your team not to discount? Why would you hire me if I discounted?
Let me ask you, what if you do all the right things and you've proved the value, everybody's on the same page, and they come back and they go, Richard, we're ready to sign. Your contract is for 10 grand. I only have 8 that I could sign today. What do you say?
Hey, David, I totally understand what you're saying. Our pricing is based on what the market will bear. And the market bears that it's 10 grand. What would you like to do? How would you like to move forward?
I want to give you 8 grand because that's all I have.
Okay. Well, here's the deal, David. There are a couple of ways we could both leverage commercial terms for benefit. Here's something I could do. You tell me what you want. For a multi-program contract, I can take off 3%. Wow. For prepayment, I could take off another 3%. And for marketing support, like with some customer quotes and things like that, I could take off another 2%. That at least gets you about an 8%. Which of those would you like to do?
Oh my God. I love it. All three. Let's
right. Let's right. Now, if they say, Richard, I don't have a, well, then I got to decide if I'm going to walk away. My first thing is, when I say this is what the market will bear, there's nothing that anybody can say that's wrong. They don't know how to answer that other than what you did. So I walked you right into what I knew I was going to say about a discount. And I just limited my discount to less than 10%. And I got something in exchange for it. Now, if David comes back and says, well, I still only have $8,000, Richard, what do we do? Well, then I got to make a decision. I got to decide, okay, am I really going to lose this deal? Can I do it and still request the marketing collateral and the support and a customer quote, which I probably would because I know David. But my goal is all this is like, I at least want to go down swinging and I want to go to bed at night knowing I did the best I could before I gave up everything. That's my ultimate goal. I want to be able to go back to my boss and say, look, here's my gong call. I did the discount thing the way you said we should do it. And they still said, no, now what do you want to do, Mr. or Mrs. Boss? Because now it's on the bosses. They can't blame the rep because the rep did what they were told. Now it's a question of what's the executives want to do? What does the company want to do?
Yeah.
All that stuff. So that's a big piece of it.
So hard. Being in sales is so hard. so much respect for salespeople. Yeah,
totally. Totally.
Let me ask you this. Why do companies not invest in sales training? They either want to hire, like lay off the underperformers and then spend a bunch of money to hire somebody who may or may not be a performer.
Meanwhile, they hired all the people they just fired. They hired all the people they just fired and they haven't changed how they're hiring.
They're doing a layoff and it's almost like, it's just weird. But at the same time, the sales training industry is like a multi-billion dollar industry. So there are companies that train their salespeople, but it seems like, especially in Silicon Valley, let's say, in our neck of the woods, they might hire you or two or three other sales training companies, but most companies will not invest.
Yes. And what I will say, traditionally what happens is that they make the cuts they make, and about 8 weeks later, they realize they still need to train the team, the people who were left, and they'll start to come back around. 23 was the most interesting year because the cuts were made and nobody spent anything. It just fell off the face of the earth completely. And I've talked to a lot of people in the business, and it's because I like to blame the CFO, but everybody was just being really tight with their money about everything. They were saying no to everything. So it's been an interesting time. Why don't they do it?
That's a nice way to put it.
Because they think they can read a book over the weekend and become a great salesperson. That's why. They don't have the skill or the desire to know what good sales training looks like. Therefore, they're afraid to make the decision. Leaders are often afraid of, why should I hire a sales trainer? Isn't that my job? I feel like my job's going to be threatened because someone's going to realize I don't know how to train and coach my team. Those are the reasons that I see. And I know most of them because I felt them myself when I was a sales leader. I was afraid of hiring a sales trainer because I was afraid I'd be found out as a fraud. I would think that people would think I was a fraud, where my skill set at that stage was a little bit of training and coaching. It was really much more around the functional and the process and the operational side. So I get it. At least I think I get it. People can tell me if I'm wrong. It's okay. Won't offend me.
And do you feel like it's starting to come back now, or at least in the tech industry? Or is your business multi-vertical? Do you work only in the tech industry, or do you work with a lot of different?
Most of my stuff is in tech, right? Most of it's in SaaS, not all of it. There's always a handful of companies that are not. A couple of years ago, General Electric was my biggest client. They found me through SEO. I'm like, wow, okay, that's working. Believe me, we were selling technical things, but they were not your traditional Silicon Valley startup, but a large percentage are.
Okay. And do you see that coming back at some point? Where is the phone ringing again?
It's starting. Yeah, no, it's starting. What I'm also seeing too is there's a lot more desire and interest for individualized coaching, like founders with founder-led sales coaching, go-to-market strategy, individual reps. Like a lot of companies are now giving that stipend to the reps where they won't pay for training, but they have a stipend, go do something on their own. So I've been doing more of that. I have that as a service. And yes, the team stuff is coming along too.
Yeah, that's great. Okay. Last question for you. There's the talk out there of the buyer's journey. It's everyone's talking about the buyer journey and you got to map to the buyer journey. But your book is called The Seller's Journey. What was your thought process there?
Yeah. The buyer's journey is the biggest lie and myth we've ever been taught, bought, and sold.
Wow. Okay.
There is only a buyer's experience through the seller's journey. David, how many apps do you have on your phone that you never use right now?
27.
Really? Like just 27? Because I know people have like 100.
I'm just taking a wild guess, but there's a lot.
Okay. And is it because there's such a shitty experience?
For some of them, yeah.
Yeah.
For others, I just don't need them.
Right. You thought you did, but you didn't. There was no buyer's journey when you got that app. You know what there was? There was a moment. There was an experience you had that said, I need to go find a solution on the app store. Some experience existed that you wanted to be different. So it starts with a buyer's experience, which then heads to a certain spot where the seller's journey begins, as well as the buyer's experience continues. There is no such thing as a buyer's journey. No, there's only a buyer's experience through the journey. And sales and marketing build that journey. Yeah, I'm really passionate about this one.
Because I always thought a buyer's journey is like, I'm sitting here and I have some sort of problem, or in the app example, like somebody wants me to download this app because I need this one app for this one purpose. I have to do that. So the beginning of my journey is, for some reason, I have to get this thing. And then I talk to...
No, but that reason is an experience. I've either had a bad experience or I desire a better experience, or I'm curious if this is... So there's something around an experience that's driving your behavior.
Right. And what you're saying is I'm not on any journey because I just get this thing and then that's it. And journey's over.
Well, no, the journey is the seller's journey.
Okay.
It's my journey. I created it. I have a landing page. I have this. You can start to look for information. So it's the seller's journey, but it's your experience through that journey. Mm-hmm. The customer actually kicks off the seller's journey based on a buyer's experience before they decided to do something.
Got it. In the book, am I going through a journey as a salesperson, like from beginning to end?
That's why I hired a publisher and an editor. Yes, because I had all this and it was a little bit all over the place. And they're like, I wanted to call the book, Yes, I'm in Sales. That was the first title.
Okay.
Like I was like, oh.
Sales call? Yeah.
Like I'm a salesperson. I'm going to own it. Yes, I'm in sales. I thought that'd speak to everybody. And they're like, well, Richard, when you read this and you've got this compass thing, it's a little bit more like you're taking them on a journey. And you've already built this compass. And I'm like, well, what do you come up with? And they're like, the seller's journey. And I had to go battle that around. I had to battle internally. And I finally said, okay, the publisher is smarter than me. I'll let them tell me this is a better title. So we found a way to make it work. And I'm so much happier with this title than I was before. Again, you know, I think I was talking earlier about how the beginning, the part of this book is a mindset piece. And the introduction, not even the first chapters, yes, I'm in sales. Because I want people to own it. I want people to feel comfortable with it. And so often we're looked down upon or we're frowned upon or people don't get it. Or they're like, oh, you couldn't be successful anywhere else. You know, whatever it is, right? There's always this negative thing about it. I want people to sort of walk in and immediately know that I get it. And yeah, it's okay for us to be proud that we're in sales. And yeah, it's a struggle and all those kind of things. So
That's how it all. And let me ask you this. You're working full time. You've got a family and everything. How do you spend the time to write a book? Because it's so time consuming.
Yeah.
And it's encompassing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I tried to start writing it in 2020. So I was like, oh, COVID, business is going to die. Let's start writing the book. And all of a sudden, my business picked up because I can deliver my training virtually or in person. So it became very, very hot, really good. So I didn't have time. And then in 2021, I still futzed around and business was good. 2022, business was great. Last year, 23, business wasn't as great. So I had time. So that's a piece of it. Now that I have written a book and I've been through the process, I think I could write another one much faster than I wrote this one because I understand the flow. Like I've already got sort of like the next thought would be some stuff around management and sales management as a journey. I got my flow down. I know the order of things. I could probably write a little faster.
That's interesting. So what if you could put it in a nutshell, what is the flow? Is it like you have to sit down and write rain or shine every day or?
No, there were times I had to because I had deadlines. That was the other reason I had a publisher is they kept me to deadlines. I have so much stuff I've written over the years. it's easy for me to go find it and then rewrite the topic. A lot of times I sort of, in this last process, I sat down and whatever I was thinking about, I put on paper and I knew to pull certain parts of my training into the book. So I knew how to, okay, I'm going to go write about that topic. I'm going to go write about that topic. In this instance, I would create what I think are the right chapters I would write. I might try to put them in order, but not necessarily. And then just when I feel like it, I'm going to go write about each one of those things. You just sort of take a snippet of it. You do one thing at a time. You don't try to write the whole book from beginning to end. I didn't even write the introduction until after the book was done because I didn't know how to introduce something I wasn't sure I was writing entirely. To your point, yes, I would block out time on my calendar for an hour a day or 30 minutes a day to write. If I tried to do it for 2 hours, it felt like an albatross to me. And I was just like, I cannot dedicate that much time.
Yeah,
I can dedicate 30 minutes. And then sometimes you get into a flow and then you might extend. But the idea of sitting down to write for 2 hours just felt overwhelming to me. That's Richard and my ADHD and all that kind of stuff. So I did calendar it out. You know me, like I'm on LinkedIn or I'll write blog posts or I'm on Modern Sales Pros. Like I do actually put time on my calendar to go write stuff.
It's so great. I mean, writing is such a great way to clarify your thoughts and structure them and just get them out of your head and onto paper.
I tell people all the time, go throw up on a sheet of paper. Mm-hmm. Don't try to organize it at all. Just go throw up. Like I'm meeting with someone in a bit and I sent her a list and I said, I just want you to list all the things that you want to work on and you are not allowed to try and prioritize them. If I get any sense that you're prioritizing, I'm going to be very upset. I know her very well, so she gets my humor.
Yeah.
Because we don't know what the priorities are. And let's face it, when you go into any business or life, you may have priorities each day, but something can come up. What was your priority yesterday may be different tomorrow. I just want people to get the idea out of their head and on paper, because that's how you can organize things. I am not good at organizing thoughts in my head. And I don't think most people are.
It's like chiseling it into a statue, you know?
I will contradict myself and I will say, I think technically minded people, math oriented people, where a logical process needs to exist, I think they can actually do that in their head better than other people. A doctor, a scientist, those kind of folks, I think accountants and finance people, like they're conditioned to do that. And I think the value of sales and sales leadership is we learn how to do that through experience. We learn how to build a sales process, a hiring process, all those things, as opposed to accounting, which they started learning theoretically in the fifth grade. They learned numbers early. So they've been conditioned in that way and leaned into that's how their mind thinks. Whereas salespeople not always are so focused on the structure and the process. So they have to relearn that piece.
Big time. Or for the first time, if you're used to shooting from the hip and a natural born improviser, it's hard to discipline and put process in place and stick to it, you know, because that's how we ended up right here.
Yeah.
Because we just make shit up as we go.
On the plus side of that, that's been the greatest thing about SaaS is that so many of these tools we use were because we weren't organized. They helped us become better organized and better at our jobs and smarter at our jobs and all that wonderful stuff. So that's a good sign.
It is. Well, I'm going over to Amazon right now. I'm going to put the link to the book in the show notes, Richard.
Thank you.
And grab the book and then we'll hit your website and sign up for the training. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your wisdom.
Yeah. Thank you, David. You know, I'm always here for you. So whatever I can do to help you, just ask. You know that.
You got it.
Thank you for listening to the Sales Development Podcast, the only audio forum 100% focused and dedicated to sales development. Please be sure to subscribe to the show on YouTube and take a moment to leave us a review on iTunes. Your support makes our show possible. If you are struggling with your sales development program, contact us at 10bound.com for a no-obligation exploratory call. Again, that's 10bound.com.